Hey everybody, it's John. I wanted to remind you that we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/alienminute. Over there on Patreon, Mitch and I discuss subjects concerning movies and television and just about anything else we want to talk about. So if you want to come over there, you can subscribe for $2 a month for one episode or $5 a month for every episode at patreon.com/alienminute. Thank you. Hello and welcome back to 007x7, the podcast where we are investigating the James Bond films 7 minutes at a time. I'm John Engel.
And I'm Mitch Bryan. And today we're looking at minutes 91 through 98, which begin with Bond asking Dr. No if toppling of missiles compensates for having no hands, and ends with Bond kicking open the grate of an air duct. In between, Bond learns about Spectre, turns down a job offer from the doctor, gets roughed up, shocked, burned, and nearly drowned as he makes his way through the ductwork of Dr. No's lair. And today we have with us playwright, director, actor, theatrical designer, activist, and founder of Kansas City's venerable drag parody troupe Late Night Theater that included a production that I saw called Shock to Pussy, the one and only Ron McGee. Welcome.
Hello. I am honored to be here.
Well, I know you're a big James Bond fan, so it seemed natural.
I know, and it's... I love that you're doing this. I really do. I love the Alien one because that's also one of my favorites. But James Bond, ooh, you can dissect this to an inch of its life.
Do you remember your first James Bond movie?
Yes. I think it was The Spy Who Loved Me, right? Yeah. At a drive-in with my sister in her 1967 convertible Mustang in the 70s.
Nice.
And I used to go to the drive-in with her and then I would fall asleep. But this was one of the first movies I sat in the back and watched.
Do you remember the parachute opening up? I suppose that's the big thing everybody remembers.
I kind of do. The weird thing is many of my early reflections of James Bond movies is playing on the swing set underneath it and seeing Roger Moore at a really, really large level, you know? And I think that's what made me gay, is seeing that.
Roger Moore made you gay.
Yes.
Well, you know, he's a great philanthropist. He's done a lot of great things for the world. So
yeah.
I guess there you go.
I agree.
Makes total sense to me. Yeah. We're going to jump into these minutes, but we may also kind of jump around a little
bit
because I want to talk about design and costume and things like that. But I also kind of want to get into these crazy minutes. I also wanted to mention, because I forgot it the last time, Dr. No's backstory. I just wanted to touch on it briefly. In the movie, he says, I was part of this, you know, Chinese Tong, and then I took their money and I got away from them, right? Well, in the book, he does that, but then they chop his hands off. And then to make sure that he's dead, they shoot him in the heart. But he then tells us that he's one in a million who's born with the heart on the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
It is a real thing, John?
Yeah, it's called dextrocardia.
Is it one in a million?
I think it's even more common. I don't know. I looked up a statistic on it, but one in a million, I mean, it is a real thing. I don't think it's necessarily that the entire heart is on the other side. I think it's that it's kind of flipped and part of the heart's on the right side. That's how I understand it. So it's a congenital defect, but I think it's exaggerated for effect here. Cause I think you're still getting shot in the heart. It's just the flipped version.
And you're bleeding
of the
out because both of your hands have been chopped off.
Well, yeah. I mean,
he's
still
very
bleeding
strong
out.
This guy.
It's clearly not like getting shot in the heart's the only way to die of a gunshot wound. I think, yeah, he's losing blood and dying in this situation.
But then the most outrageous thing is that he still manages to escape with the gold, the money from the Chinese Tongs.
Right.
And he decides that the way to protect his investment is to buy stamps. So he spends like $1 million on what he says are rare stamps so that he can move them around the country. It's just so ridiculous.
Did he buy all the upside down Wright Brothers stamps or something?
Yeah. And then he's got to go fence them, you know? And so, right. So he's like this, got the most expensive stamp collection in the world, and he's going to turn it into his criminal empire. And, it's just, I don't know.
Stamp books are hard to maneuver anyway with the way you have to put them in. And so if you had metal hands, wouldn't that be really difficult? Man. Like, what a thing to pick. Like, they're like, oh, I'll pick.
He's like dropping tweezers all the time.
So anyway, I just wanted to bring that to the, because I think that will fit into a larger conversation when we talk a little bit more about.
Well, on that, Mitch, he's described, I mean, it's interesting, by the time the movie is made, he's Euro-Asian. I mean, that's a big step, even though I think, didn't one of the writers quit over this? I mean, because he was so, they didn't want him to be like a Charlie Chan Breakfast at Tiffany's kind of character. And so they came up with this Euro-Asian, because he's not in the book, right? I don't remember him being Euro-Asian.
He is. He's German. He has a German father and a Chinese mother in the book. Yeah. But still, he looks like a giant worm in the book. I mean, he's bald.
Oh,
he has black contact lenses. He's 6'6". He pinchers for hands. Yeah. I mean, he's almost like a giant insect.
And the best line in it is they describe him in a gunmetal kimono that's oversized. And this is the line: is the bizarre gliding figure looked like a giant venom of worm wrapped in tinfoil.
Wow.
That is the best line.
Hard to translate that onto film, though, I would think. I bet the costuming department and the makeup department looked at that and said, no, we got to do something different here, because that sounds...
The great thing about it is Tessa, Prendergast, Prendergast.
Yeah.
She decided to go with this new look, which was coming out of India, which was the Nehru jacket. And, I mean, we're fortunate enough, because then villains from then on had Nehru jackets.
I know. Isn't that wild?
Yes. And spoofed it. I mean, look at Austin Powers. I mean, once again, the Nehru jacket comes back. It's so intriguing to me. And it started a fashion craze.
Right. And it was a guy named Nehru, right, that made it famous. It wasn't
originally
called the Nehru jacket. He wore them a lot. I can't remember his first name.
But I do know that it had a long name, and then he was famous for wearing them, and so they started calling him the Nehru jacket.
Then they're everywhere throughout the 60s. Beatles, might have seen the Monkees wearing a Nehru jacket at some point, even, you know. So, yeah,
I had one in grade school that was lime green.
What?
Yeah, it was a lime green Nehru shirt with a Nehru collar. Yeah.
Is this about the time that Kirk's wearing that wraparound lime green tunic that you like so much, Mitch?
You know what's so sad is it probably is about the same time, but I hadn't discovered Kirk in his wraparound lime green until syndication. So I missed that in the first run of Star Trek. And I think this probably would have been 66, 67, 68 when I had one.
Yeah.
Like I was like in second or third grade. What possessed my mother? I know I asked for it. I do remember that. I wanted a shirt with a Nehru collar.
Wow.
So my mother indulged me.
I had a dark blue one. There's a picture of me at Disneyland in it.
Oh, really? Nice.
And I'm wearing corduroy bells and a Nehru jacket. I thought I looked really good. But it was 1975, so...
You fit right into It's a Small World. You
looked exactly.
In the 80s, there was that short, very short trend of taking collars off of button-up shirts. I remember having a couple of those, probably from Walmart or something when I was a kid. Not quite Nehru. But probably slightly inspired by it.
I need to just say that there's a cricket behind me. I don't know if you guys can hear it, but Jiminy Cricket is here with us in my basement. But just pretend like I'm in Jamaica or something, and it's the sound of crickets at night, and the rum's coming, and it's going to be wonderful. So I want to also mention this guy standing behind Bond as he sits at the table, this big guard, who is a guy named Milton Reed. And he has appeared in, I looked him up, and I guess he's been in 3 James Bond movies. He was in the Casino Royale spoof. And he was also in The Spy Who Loved Me. And he's the guy that James Bond fights on the roof. And his name is Sandor. And he fights him on the roof. And I think he's the guy he lets fall over the roof, right? The guy that says feckish. And then Roger Moore slaps the tie out. And the guy tumbles back. But he was apparently lobbying really hard for the part of Oddjob. And there was even, he'd even proposed wrestling Harold Sakata. And the winner would get the role, but the producers didn't go for that. But I just recognized him because I remember Dr. Fibes Rises Again, and he's the butler who goes and picks up the phone, and it's those old-timey phones where, you know, you have the speaker part in one hand and the ear thing in the other, and he puts the earpiece on and they blow a golden spiked snake spike from one ear to the next and kill him that way.
I do like that he's in that shot for so long and you don't see his head. It's just this massive body of something. It really is. I mean, it takes up a lot of screen.
Yeah.
You know, with James Bond. I mean, it's really wild.
And it would be disappointing if they hadn't done anything with him. So, yeah, you know, he's just looming because he's going to beat the crap out of James Bond soon.
In an ill-fitting suit. I mean, in a, you know, his military outfit is ill-fitting, which is also great. I just...
Well, what did you think of the design of this room? I wanted to get your take on this lair.
It's, first off, it's brilliant because we know that Sir Ken Adam, you know, built three giant sets at Pinewood. And one of them was this. And when they got to this, they only had 745 pounds left. I mean, they built this set with 745 pounds, which I don't know what that is nowadays. I mean, that's still not very much. And so their creativity on it, his idea of German expressionism mixed with antiques and modernism. I mean, it is crazy. I mean, like, you probably already discussed this, but the Goya painting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, what? And also that the Goya, for the Brits, that was funny because it had really been stolen out of the museum and stuff. So, and that Ken painted that Goya painting the day before filming as a joke, you know, I mean, but back to that thing, it is, so they get to that week of they're getting ready to finish the set and they can't afford this aquarium. And so they, I guess, get stock footage, but it's little fish. And so they decide to say, magnify it. And they actually make them put a line in it that Dr. No says, through my magnified screen of these fish. And it's really little baby fish. I mean, it also revolutionized. From then on, aquariums started being in a lot of layers and evilness. And I think it's so clever. And that desk, oh my God, when he turns in, that desk is just stunning piece, just in there with that cold concrete. And then you have these antique pieces mixed in, including the chairs. Did you notice the heads on the on the top of the chair? I mean, like, it's like, ooh, this, it's like they raided the Pinewood's you know, prop room and set decorating, and we're like, we'll try to go find us some weird chairs and we only have a dollar, so go, you know. And they're like, well, we found these with a head on them, we'll use these. Okay, great.
Well, what do you think it communicates, that weird mix of those things?
Well, it's cold, it's on the verge of Nazism. I mean, what we think, and then you think, well, Ken did escape from Germany in real life,
right,
with his family to Great Britain, and he had a distaste for Nazis and that, but still loved the aesthetic of German expressionism. And so I think he's just thrown it all into this. I mean, and then it goes on. I mean, if we're going to sidebar into Ken for a second, he invented one of the most incredible sets ever in Dr. Strangelove. Look at the war room. I mean, it's famous. That war room is famous. And it all came out of this, you know what I mean? Things that he couldn't put in Dr. No, he put in Dr. Strangelove and then started putting them into different Bond movies. And also one of your favorites, Mitch, he won an Oscar for...
Yeah, for Barry Lyndon.
Barry Lyndon.
Yeah, which doesn't look like a Ken Adam movie. There's no sloping walls in that one.
No, and And his fights with Kubrick are famous, and they're in his book, you know, over that movie is very interesting to me. But one of the funniest things, I think, is Ken's with the James Bond people are the ones that did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I mean, Ken invented the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang car and the child catcher. I mean, he invented that look and the character and everything. And you're like, whew, you know, it's, I just think it's layered. He lived for a long time. I mean, he just died, what, 3-4 years
ago? Yeah, he just died.
He did Adam's Family Values. I mean, he did a lot of really fun movies, but I'm obsessed with him because it started a craze. People all of a sudden wanted that. That all of a sudden became 1960s. Altered the look of 1960s.
What I think so interesting is when you look at the sketches that he does for these sets, the lines are just so simple. Like, he works in triangles all the time, so you've always got this one sloped wall, and maybe that's also part of the charm of it, is that it has such a simple structure to it. Look at the war room. It's one big circle hanging over a smaller circle and one slanted wall, and that's it, but it's brilliant.
He does that in the cell that Bond is put in, just a little bit. That incredible angle and the lighting, and you know that set is so dinky, and they were like, well, let's... And he's like, makes it the most severe. I mean, it's a severe cell.
Oh, yeah.
The floor, those concrete slabs. I mean, it's really good, you know, for a quick set.
Yeah.
And also for the price for that whole area. It's like, wow. It just shows that, okay, you don't have much money, so you're really going to have to use your imagination. And I think I really dig that, you know. It's like, I base my theater on that. Look, we got $5. Let's build a set, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And when you lean into that expressionism, which isn't supposed to be real to begin with, suddenly it frees you up for all sorts of things. I think that's what's so amazing about this movie, is it's so realistic, except when he goes to pick up the spider. And then when we get to Dr. No's lair, and all of a sudden in those moments, we've just jumped into this crazy fantasy movie.
Well, in his book, in Ken's book, his whole thing was... He had to make an... Oh, let me make... Okay, yeah. I had to make a nuclear reactor with a 5-star hotel. That's what he was given. And I was like, whoa. I was like, that is so twisted. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, here we go. And, you know, and then from then on, and you guys probably can go into this more, but as the sets became more elaborate, the layers... We expected it. I mean, it's still even to this day, I think Skyfall, I think all of them still have, we want the lair, you know, this criminal world that's cold and harsh. And, you know, I don't know. It's so cool.
Yeah. I just watched Quantum of Solace. And at the end of that is this big glass structure, totally modern. And I just thought about that, the ghost of Ken Adam, you know, lives through all of these Bond movies, because there is an expectation of modernity in all these pictures.
Yeah, it's, and I think this movie in general shook up that, you know, shook up what spies and all that. And we've seen it. It's not stopped. I mean, he certainly set a tone that never went away. And he didn't get to do the second one. He did the third one, right?
Right. He did the third one and fourth one. And yeah, there were every so often he'd be off on another picture and he'd miss one. But he had an art director, Sid Kane, who worked with him on all the movies. And so when Ken Adam wasn't there, Sid Kane would take over the production design and would make a real effort to try to keep things in the same kind of visual continuity.
Well, and on You Only Live Twice is the first time he was given $1 million for a set. For one set. And they used more steel than was in the British Hilton. I mean, like, more steel. They put a real monorail in. Let us be clear here.
Right.
They put a working monorail. And it's like, as a set designer, you're like, well, I want a working monorail. I mean, like, what? Okay.
That's why that one's the standard bearer to me of what I think of as the quintessential James Bond set piece, you know, third act set piece. And when you get to, you know, that's the one that you see in Austin Powers. That's the one that people, I think, kind of have come to expect. And then, you know, the graphic design, the poster art and everything really leaned into it. And that's what I, you know, I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but that's always been my favorite Bond film because of it, basically, because of how much the design was enhanced and just how big and iconic it becomes, the hollowed out
volcano. Those are the words. Like, all you have to say is hollowed out volcano and people know exactly what you're talking about, even if you're talking
about James
yeah,
Bond.
Yeah, even if you're talking about
parodies of James Bond.
Yeah, or does Elon Musk live in a hollowed out volcano? You're like, I know what that is referencing. I know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. I just think it's genius and the his forced perspective on that volcano, but he also did it in Dr. No. I mean, he that control nuclear control room, which tells you when things are, I mean, there's signs that say,
I know.
It's so bizarre, but it's interesting that you get to watch him grow as a designer and also what money does. It's really interesting what money will do through. And, but they were making this on a shoestring budget. I mean, they picked this one, I assume because it only had two locales. I mean, Jamaica and London, really. I mean,
yeah, that's exactly because they were going to do Thunderball and then they were like, it's too big, we can't pull that off. And so they decided, well, this one's tropical and it's got, you know, blue waters and it's beautiful and it's got futuristic kind of stuff. So we'll do Dr. No instead.
And if they tried to pull that now, everybody would be, what's going on? Why are we only going to two places? Yeah. Like now it's that's another expectation. It's the travelogue expectation. You got to, I mean, one of the first things that you'll hear is when they release, well, we're doing a new Bond. Here's where we're going. That'll be like on the opening day press release is the locations. Because people are more, they don't care about the plot. They don't care who's in it even as much as they care about where they're going a lot of the time. So now I think you get a minimum of four places, right? You have to go at least four places.
Oh, I bet they do. I bet they're like, only four, you know, they're like, no, we need seven and one's got to be so exotic, you know, some island that none of us have heard of.
And so there's a guy, there'll be a character. Okay. There's this character in the script. There's no reason that character has to be in, you know, wherever in Thailand, but we'll put him in Thailand because we want to shoot in Thailand and that's it. Well, that guy's there. We have to go there. And then it's dun, 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 dun and establishing shot Thailand, you know? So it's funny how it's changed since Dr. No, but again, budget, you know, and then the subsequent films, like they go more places as the movies go along, I think.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
If they exponentially do or not, maybe not. I don't know. Like the, you only live twice really just goes to Japan. You only live twice. It really only goes to Japan, right? Maybe that is one that they don't. I'm trying to think of how many locations there are in that movie, but I think there's only like three, maybe.
Yeah, it's all over Japan. The whole thing is shot in different parts of Japan.
Yeah. Which is its own kind of travelogue, I guess. You know, but yeah.
Well, and then Ken's, the Jamaica, which he, you know, they used a lot of exterior, people's homes and...
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about it is it exploded for Jamaica after this movie, like to tourism. To come and see this world, this James Bond world. Well, Jamaica had just become an independent country when this movie came out, like 2 weeks before this movie came out. And it was overwhelming for Jamaica on what this movie did for them. Like it put Jamaica on the map.
Yeah, it went from something like there were 500 hotel rooms on the whole island, and then it went to like some crazy like 15,000 or something within just a couple of years. It was really a huge tourist boom for the country. Yeah.
And then it quote coincided with the music boom, as we have our friend Chris Blackwell in the movie then carries that music over to England with Island Records. Chris Blackwell,
yeah,
right?
Chris Blackwell.
I got the name right. And he carries the music over into England, where then reggae and rocksteady ska and everything becomes this phenomenon. And suddenly Jamaica is coming at you from all different directions. And they did have this big tourist boom. And then a lot of political strife that came along with it later, you know, but.
And then one of the James Bond people, and it might've been him, bought Marley's.
Chris Blackwell, who owned Island Records, the Bob Marley record label, bought GoldenEye. Where Ian Fleming wrote and turned it into is that what you're thinking of?
That's what it is. I knew it involved property even being bought, you know.
Yeah.
My favorite is that Noel Coward flew in for them to film this to stay at his house and would have cocktail parties and dinner parties late at night and became friends with Sean Connery. First off, Fleming's Gay Friends alone is really interesting, how it's influenced and influenced Dr. No, the actual character, is really intriguing to me in all its levels. But that's a sidebar. We can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we could just talk about that. I wanted to get into some of the dialogue here at the dinner table because we haven't talked a lot about what's going on between this interplay between Bond and Dr. No. And specifically, we start right off in these minutes with the line where Bond takes a shot at his disability, right? Yes. So he's trying to undercut his masculinity by saying, oh, was it worth all of it to not have your hands? And I mean, a little bit ableist. I don't know. Ableism, I don't know if it applies to a guy that stole gold and got his hands cut off for it or not.
And who's toppling missiles too.
Right, yeah. Right. And all that. But at the same time, that is the mindset. The mindset is from the masculine point of view of James Bond, you take shots at of another person's physicality,
yes.
However it's depleted. And how that then plays into, I mean, that's a Fleming-esque thing to do. Like there's women with physical deformities, there's gay characters with physical deformities or other issues throughout Fleming's books and the movies as well. So I thought we should talk about that maybe a little bit. I think we've only kind of glossed over that in previous episodes. So,
well, I think one thing about Fleming is, and one of the controversial things is that if we bring up the gay characters, is a lot of them are evil or have a deformity or something disabling. And it's interesting that also this, we expected after this movie that most villains, something is horribly wrong with them or that their faces are mangled or whatever. And that puts a second level of evilness. Like, I'm also mad at the world as he shakes his metal hands, you know, like when he goes to show his strength with the hands, which he does with the Buddha. Yeah. I think because of what Bond said is one of the things is like, you know, you think I'm weak because of these hands. Well, I'm going to crush this rubber Buddha.
This rubber Buddha with a background right. That matches nothing else in the entire room.
Nothing. And when he goes down to grab it and it bounces, you know, you see actually it's rubber. And then he crushes it and then it drops off the table. And then when we flash back to when he stands up, it's back on the table. And you're like, oh. Wow, Buddha, that is a crazy rubber Buddha. Hey, like, I just like,
he's Buddha, you know?
I shall crush this rubber Buddha. And the sound effects with it, whoever's doing the sound effects, because they even have a sound effect when it hits the table and then the floor and it goes, it has a really metal, I mean, it's full on metal sound. Like, yeah. It's like, oh, you go sound people. That's, you're going to make us believe this Buddha.
So this is clearly a seduction scene. You know, I mean, Dr. No is trying to seduce James Bond into coming and work for him and who knows what else. And Bond just is not having it. It's like he is deflecting every single approach that Dr. No can take. And Dr. No seems really honestly disappointed.
I totally agree. And the way they frame it with that fish tank behind him, on the Dr. No section, and then also his Nehru jacket being a lighter color, and they're putting the darker color on Bond to switch what I thought was good and evil.
Right.
And where Dr. No feels that he's doing good, and just the framing of it, because Bond's side, we've already talked about, all he gets is a very large man in a, you know, a suit thing and three grapes on his plate. But Dr. No is framed beautifully. I mean, it is a, And that also they have that prosthetic eyes to make him Asian-ish. And if you look, it looks rubber. Something's wrong with his eyes as you watch it. So that's also more sinister also. I was like, what is wrong with your eyes, Dr. No? You know, that's where I went with it. But I had also been drinking, so I was like.
Oh. but he does sort of lean into all of those physical restrictions in that performance, you know? And so I don't know whether the result of that is, like, does it make him asexual? Does it make him, I mean, what, you know, I don't know what we're supposed to think about the, you know, the inner life of Dr. No by the way he sort of carries himself.
I know that in the queer canon of history, Dr. No is in one of the top villains as someone who may have gay tendencies or whatever. But I thought he was asexual. I thought there was, the man has no love. I mean, I felt that he was just a, something about it. I totally agree with you. I'm not sure how to put it into words, but I was like, man, he is cold and ruthless. And then, but he tries to put warmth. I don't know. It's so crazy. I just love it.
And he's surrounded by such high style. That's the other thing. Because like a fur rug on the floor and then...
And Dom Perignon on the... I mean, he's serving Dom Perignon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, what? I mean, which that means high style right there.
Right, right.
And if that's product placement, I'm blown away. You know, I mean, that... I think if you look at... That would be a really fun thing to do is go through all the Bond films and watch the great product placement.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the first times we get to see high, high product placement on a Bond film. I mean, if it was meant on purpose, if Dom Perignon was like a sponsor or whatever, I don't know. But I thought, oh, that's a, that actually shows you the wealth of Dr. No.
Yeah. And the, yeah, for sure. And the, and it's peppered with all sorts of things like the different choices of cigarettes that you could have, you know, when he's offered different brands and or different from different countries and all of this just high living that is surrounding Dr. No. But that is so odd because he doesn't look like he's having much fun with it all.
No. And then on that, too, is we know he's very intelligent. I mean, if we would just look at somehow he is such an incredible host, which a gay man would do is to find the sizes of your hostages beforehand so that they had really good fitting Nehru jackets. I mean, like including pants and shoes. Let us remember that Alcini was provided shoes. So like, wow, that is some detail. That is something a gay man would do. It'd be like, I need to know their sizes before we capture them and give them poison in a teacup, which is never explained, like going to let you sleep for a little bit. I mean, I don't think it's ever explained.
No,
I mean,
it isn't.
It's like, is it in the book, Mitch? Both of you, is the poisoning in the book? I can't remember.
Yeah. They're knocked out. Okay. The coffee knocks them out. Yeah. But just, so Dr. No can come in and look at, in the book, he comes in and looks at Honey, which is rather interesting, pulls the sheets down and looks at her naked. But in the movie, he comes in and looks at James Bond. He's much more interested in James Bond.
Yeah. I just think it's so twisted. I just like, there's some, I don't know that, and his employees. Oof.
Yeah. The sisters, Sister Lily and yes. Sister Rose. So this does bring me to the question. Is this high camp at the end of the day?
In the end? Yes. I mean, it's become camp now. I mean, I don't know at the time. And I know that secretly this is a weird thing that's in a Hollywood book. It's not Hollywood Babylon, but the other one about the queerness in cinema is they talk about James Bond movies for gay men, starting with Dr. No, was a secret way for two men to go to the movie theater, because it was a man's movie, sit together and watch a movie. And it became this underground thing where gay men could go to a cinema with another man and watch a film. And then also you put in Sean Connery, which is the most masculine man you could get. He's beautiful. I mean,
yeah, he's really beautiful in this.
He really is. And that beginning blue, a short sleeve Terry outfit. Oh God. And the tightness, the way the costume designer is sewed in the side. So it looks like his pecs are bigger than they need to be. And I mean, it's pretty impressive. And so it has a secret level, which I think becomes camp.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also how they live, you know, all Bond films have that. And Fleming also in many of his novels touched upon any of this. I mean, Pussy Galore in his book was with her henchwomen were a lesbian circus troupe called the Cement Mixers. I mean, right there, which they didn't put in the movie because it was too controversial to have a pack of lesbians that kill. I mean, it's so interesting to me, and I think that this is all Fleming's doing on camp. I mean, it's so out there.
I think so too. You know, I think that it's so outrageous and he plays it so straight faced that you have to see it as camp.
Yes.
There's a sexual undertone to everything, you know, in it. And whether how much he knows, well, I mean, he knows what he's doing. I don't know whether he really knows what he's doing, but he certainly knows enough that his tongue is definitely in his cheek, and he's having us on. And that's right. Why there's very few jokes in the books. And that was Fleming's big fear, was he was afraid the movies were going to be too jokey. And he was afraid even that Alfred Hitchcock would make it too jokey. And it's kind of funny. It's because it's like the whole thing's kind of a big joke to start with, you know?
Right. And this doesn't have very many one-liners, James Bond one-liners through it. I mean, later on, we get more of the dry humor quip of James Bond. But it's very interesting to me that Fleming, you know, because like Somerset Maugham was one of his best friends, and they discussed the writing of this. And you wonder what influence on Dr. No and on Bond on these levels came out of that. Because we know that part of it's based on Somerset, right? I mean, he was a spy, right?
Well, Fleming was a spy. I mean, Fleming worked in intelligence. Yeah.
Oh, there were a lot of letters written, Somerset Maugham and Noel Coward. Lots of letters looking for advice, taking notes on manuscripts that are on record. So there was a lot of influence from both of them. So you know, how that influenced the overall idea of James Bond, I don't know, but there was something there for sure.
Well, and I find it interesting that it goes all the way through the films. I mean, there's always could be a gay character. Sometimes it's obvious, like the henchman and God.
Diamonds Are Forever. Yeah.
Yeah. Mint.
Oh yeah.
Winton Kidd. Yeah.
My God, killing, and then don't they hold hands at one point?
They do, yeah.
And then it goes all the way to Skyfall when Raoul's torturing him and says, I bet this is the first time that you've ever had a man handcuff you. And he's like, why do you think it's the first time?
Yeah, I think that's like a great moment.
Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, you know, you're like, and then you also have Pussy Galore in her lesbian troupe, and she's turned from being a lesbian by Bond. That's how powerful he is. They have sex in a barn, and that turns her.
It works every time.
It really does.
Yeah, it's amazing. I guess I should mention here at the dinner table, we do have the first mention of Spectre, which is the most ridiculous acronym that's ever been invented, but that's okay.
And read so... He reads it so coldly, too. It's amazing that he gets through that acronym.
Spectre, Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, Extortion.
The straightest possible face, so dry. And it's like, did he just say what I think he said? Because that's absurd.
And of course, Spectre's not in the book. Spectre was created in Thunderball, and it was sort of a holdover from that. And this would become the thing that would bedevil the Bond movies forever, because Thunderball, as probably everybody knows, was the story was co-written by a guy named Kevin McClory, and Thunderball was where they had come up with Spectre. And so the producers decided, we don't want to have our villains aligned with any nationality, so we'll grab that Spectre idea from Thunderball, we'll put it in Dr. No, and from now on this will be our overarching villainous institution that Bond will be coming up against again and again. What they didn't realize was that Kevin McClory would soon bring lawsuits against them, saying that he owns a piece of James Bond. He owns Spectre, and he's going to make trouble for them until they finally make him a producer on Thunderball, thinking that would make him go away, but not a chance. He badgered them again and again until he remade Thunderball as Never Say Never Again, and he was going to do it again before he died. It became his lifelong obsession to just, I don't know whether he was more interested in trolling Broccoli and Saltzman or whether he really down deep believed he was part of James Bond, but he was the ultimate corporate villain through all this stuff. So unwittingly, Spectre is...
For 50 years, 50 right? Years, yeah. It took 50 years for them to finally get Spectre 100% under their control, which is... I don't know. Was it worth it?
No, that movie was not worth it.
Well, the movie Spectre definitely wasn't worth it, but even having the concept of Blofeld character, I mean, Why worry about it? I don't know.
There's another gay moment in a movie when he's in disguise in that Dolly Parton wig trying to escape.
Oh, in Diamonds Are Forever?
Oh, my God.
It's Charles Gray, too, who was, you know, from who would be in Rocky Horror Picture Show, who was kind of a gay icon as well.
Yeah, and then they put him in drag. It's like, what? In a really bad Dolly Parton wig. Like, I don't know if that's a Dolly Parton wig, but that in my mind, I'm like, that's a bad wig. Like, that, I mean, that's a twist right there. And then I just think it's so interesting. And Broccoli was so anti-homosexuality. And so they were worried on several of the movies that it would be too gay. Who was the one James Bond, end of the 60s, one time only?
Lazenby, George Lazenby.
Yes, and so they sent a girl up to sleep with them.
Because he was a model, and they thought that just carried with it the gay thing.
Yeah.
all male models are gay, apparently, according to
exactly.
that.
Exactly, and yeah. You can turn them just like you can pussy galore. You can just turn them. Really,
if you have
just
a barn.
If you have a barn.
You have to have a barn and some hay or it's not going to work.
I did want to say about Spectre, using Spectre in order to avoid any alignment with any, you know, particular part of the world or any political affiliation. You know, if that was done as a way to appease any markets, they sure undid that by Bond saying, oh, disregard for human life. You must be working for the East.
Yeah, it's right.
Like, yeah. Just flat out taking a shot at all people that live in the East, I guess. So I thought that was funny. So that was the reasoning behind it at all. I don't know if it is. It would be now. Of course, we know they would never let anyone say that in a movie, a blockbuster film now, because you have that the all, you know, powerful Chinese market film. But I don't know. Was that going on back then, Mitch?
No, I don't think so. I think the bigger issue with because clearly they didn't care that they were making a Fu Manchu villain and they were putting phony eyes on everybody.
Right.
I think the biggest concern was really with Russia, because we were at the height of the Cold War. And that was why in From Russia with Love, it's not Smersh. It's not the Russians trying to get James Bond. It's Spectre. And it's not like that in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I think their real concern was to try to just keep it apolitical. I may always love it when producers say they're making apolitical movies, because we know that all film is political, no matter what. But yeah, I think that was more of their concern. I'm not sure how concerned they were even about the Chinese market. I don't even know if there was a Chinese market outside.
Yeah, there wasn't one, I guess, back then, right? Or there might have been a Japanese market, but
I mean, like, it was big in Japan, and it had the best poster. I mean, that the poster that now is a collector's item that says, we don't want a doctor. That's the title. They couldn't translate Dr. No, so it came out to, we don't want a doctor. And they printed all these posters, but then it was too late. And so Japan had this whole market of, we don't want a doctor, was the first, which was Dr. No.
Oh, wow.
Since James Bond clearly turns down all offers of working for Spectre, and after being insulted and called a stupid policeman by Dr. No, Dr. No tells them to soften him up. He's got more plans for him, and leaves the room. And
through that great door that slides, which
And then, you know, and that elegant pan to the right, like, they start beating him up off camera. We follow Dr. No out, and then we have this really kind of elegant pan over to them working over James Bond in the chair.
It's really weak workover, too. That's what the sounds when it's not on them. You think it's going to be really intense and bloody. And then when they come back, that big guy, which you said has been in other Bond films, he's like, just there's two hits or something. But the sound with it is like, oh, my God, that's it looks it doesn't match up in my eyes. It's like, that's a loud sound for what you just did. I just
And then he falls into frame in the next shot, and his clothes are dirty, his pants are ripped. Like, what did these guys do after we left the dining room?
Well, that V-neck tee underneath is completely destroyed.
Like, right.
Did they say, take off your Nehru jacket, and then they just rip and tear and beat him and then put the Nehru jacket back on? Because I was like,
I guess so.
I know. I was so confused.
I was so confused. I was like, wow, that is something really happened right there that we just didn't get.
He's even got a big hole with blood around it on his side when he finally takes off that jacket, so which we can we'll get there. But yeah, I was really confused because now they throw him into this amazing cell that we were just talking about with these high walls and
electric ductwork. I mean, like there's an electric panel on the ductwork,
which it seems to be good for one shock, and that's about it.
Right, and then he beats it with his shoe. This is one of the things. Continuity, but he beats it with the shoe and it looks like he drops the shoe, but when he crawls back through he has both of his shoes on, so you're like, wait a minute, did we miss a shot? Like, I always thought that they had a cut scene of him being beat up and also what's happening in the cell. I feel like we're missing something.
I do too.
Could be.
I don't think they shot it, and I don't know whether it was even in the script, because weirdly enough in the book, the reason that they drop him into this cell and they don't beat him up beforehand is because Dr. No has designed an elaborate obstacle course that's going to test his physical endurance and torture him as he goes through this whole thing.
To an octopus fight at the end,
right. So none of that in the movie. So they've beat the crap out of him. They've dropped him into this cell. But for what reason? What use could Dr. No possibly have for James Bond at this point?
I mean, maybe he does have the obstacle course for, and he says he's not done with them yet. So this is just to soften him up for whatever reason. Now, I can't understand that part, but maybe that is what his plan is. You know, he's going to do all of his all of his business with the missiles. And then afterwards he's going to run Bond through the obstacle course. And
I don't
and
know.
So maybe he's just holding him.
I don't know.
What else he got?
There's only one way in and out of that cell other than the door. And you would think that Dr. No would have better plans because it's not going to work out real well.
Well, somehow he had better plans because it's an air duct that happens to have thousands of gallons of water going through it. That is the weirdest thing ever. Like, you're going, he's in a hot air duct. Uh-oh, water. You're like, wait a minute. So I thought that was the maze that Dr. No set up. I thought that he forced him to go through that.
Well, they may have just not acknowledged it in any way that makes any sense. But that's maybe what's going on. Although he manages to get out at a point later on in the minutes we didn't cover and wreak all sorts of havoc. So I'm not sure whether did Dr. No think that water was going to pour him over the edge and into the
octopus
pit?
Or knock off his toupee and then he would be too embarrassed to come out.
Yeah, that's possible.
I just love that out of this whole movie, we stay on some scenes, but for some reason, and it looks like it's the same shot over and over. I mean, that they just have him keep crawling through this one.
They had one piece of pipe and a curve, and that's all they had. Literally,
right.
Really.
Part of the wall, like, I would say it's probably 10 seconds, 20 seconds before the water hits. The wall looks like it's soft. He touches the wall, and it looks like it gives a little.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, we need more pipe. Okay, we got this cardboard, you know. It's like, make this pipe, you know. And it also has my favorite moment because it's a really long freeze on the stunt double's face.
Yeah.
You can see the stunt double. It's not Bond. I'm almost sure of it.
I'm sure because Terrence Young said that he was feeling really cocky, the director, and he said, oh, let me show you, Sean. You can do this stunt. Just watch. I'm going to do it first. And so apparently Terrence Young laid down and they put the water through and it nearly killed Terrence Young. He said he couldn't hold on and he flipped him around and Connery was like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And so they did get Bob Simmons to come in and a stuntman to come in and do that. Yeah.
So that was, I wondered, because it's like, that's not Bond's face when he looks back up through and then the final splash over Bond after the second time and his hair and he's pushing it back and you're like, oh, that's a bad shot.
He adjusts his hair and you know that this is not a good move, but we don't have time. We got to keep shooting. Next, moving on.
He takes off the Nehru jacket because of the heat.
Yeah.
That's the part that gets me is that t-shirt underneath. It has been through hell and back. And then of course it shows his physical, you know, I mean, it's cut beautifully. I mean, it's torn beautifully. It's cut beautifully. I I think that the costume designer was like, well, let's really show his body in this tube. And then when he gets to knock out the, you know, the grate,
yeah,
he's completely dry too.
Yeah.
And the t-shirt's now even more form fitting. And you're like, wow, what happened in that tube? And you're like, we're missing some tube things.
We're missing when the hot air, like blow dryer hot air came through.
Yes.
For a while there. That's what we're missing.
I noticed that the force perspective at the back of the tubes, the tubes will move that he's in, but the force perspective tube at the end stays in place, which is supposed, yes, to be all part of the same thing. So that kind of a tip off there too.
See, I will say this about the tube, like the cell to into the tube, the whole thing. It's ineffective in one way, in that as a certified claustrophobe, it does nothing for me. Like, I do not feel any claustrophobia through any of this. Wherein, like, Bishop getting into the pipe and aliens and so on, yeah, gives me severe anxiety. But I think the sound design of all this is great. Very effective. When he's in the cell, there's a certain level of quiet that you don't get a lot in this movie. There's a certain level of quiet that leads to the shock, which the shock is a proper jump, yeah, scare. And that works really well. And then when he's going through this tube, if you let yourself go a little bit, kind of go with the sound design of it, it's working. It's eerie. Yeah. There's sounds coming from all these different directions, and you can kind of feel the labyrinthine nature of it all. But if you're looking to be like actually feel like you're in a tube or any kind of that kind of a sensory experience is watching, it's not convincing. Right. I don't think it works on that level, but the sound design does. So that in this case, where the sound design has failed this movie a few times, I think here they did a really good job.
Yeah, it does. It has some weird echo things in it that are really cool, especially after he drops and then goes through that next set of tubes. There's some really good. Yeah, I don't know. You're right about the sound. I really do. I like the sound in this movie. I thought it was on the verge of kitsch. I mean, there are some levels where things shouldn't be as loud as they are. And that, of course, makes me laugh. And I love that, you know.
We're going all the way back to the song, you know, in the Bay Area when he's talking to Quarrel, that doesn't change. The sound doesn't change. The direction of the sound doesn't change at all, no matter where they go. That song is the same volume, no matter where they are in that scene, even when they cut to a different location. So sometimes it's like you can tell the cheapness of the sound design. But here, I mean, it helps. In this case, I think it helps you lean into the movie a little bit, because right now we're still not 100% sure what Dr. No's lair is. We've only seen the parts that they've shown us that get increasingly more interesting. Right. And then here we're in this severe cell, we're in this tube, but these sounds are making us go, what is this place? What is going to be happening? What are we going to see next? And what is the expanse of it? Which then I think aids them in the next sequence when you actually get to the lair as you know, where the action takes place. I think we're kind of sold on the idea that it's a little bit more impressive than it really is. You know, he's hearing these sounds coming from all these different directions. I picture this massive complex beneath him or something, you know? So I think the sound design here really works.
I think you're right. I think now this goes back to Ken saying that we went out of the 5-star hotel and now we're going into the nuclear reactor and it's all through this tube. You know what I mean? I think mm-hmm. we're about ready to cross through to have the, you're right. I like that. Well, I just want it to be known that Ursula's bathing suit that Tessa designed with Ursula, I mean, they designed that together. I mean, it went at Christie's auction for £40,000 to Planet Hollywood. I mean, it became so iconic. And same with the Nehru jacket, was that from this movie, many iconic things came out of it. And I just had to bring up her bathing suit because it's one of the sexiest, I mean, oh God, it is sexy. And I'm just going to keep saying that word until you guys say something.
And they made it from three bathing suits, right? They got three bathing suits from Saks Fifth Avenue or something like that. Some New York sort of, you know, and built it. The two of them somehow built that thing.
And it became like every woman wanted that bathing suit.
Oh yeah, and the cover of Playboy, 1964 Playboy, had the Playboy model in that bathing suit.
I just want to ask, a fun aside, what is the most iconic article of clothing in Bond history? Is it the bathing suit? Is it the terry cloth robe in Goldfinger? The gray suit in Goldfinger, maybe, yeah.
But you know what's so interesting about you saying that, the robe, is we get to see the very first time Bond wears a terry cloth robe in this movie, which is the powdered blue bathrobe that he gets from
Dr. No.
Right before, from Dr. No in this first scene. Remember? He puts, mm-hmm. That's the first terry cloth robe. And from then on, they said the robes, you know, progress to what they...
I think it's iconic. If you see a terry cloth robe cut at that level, I think of James
especially
Bond
if it's blue.
Immediately. I don't know. Especially if it's blue. I don't know who else you are. The only other man that wears something cut off at that level in popular culture that I could think of is like the guy from Futurama or something. You know,
yes.
It's like Bond really made that iconic. It's not iconic in the same way as the suit or the bathing suit, maybe.
I thought you were talking about the powder blue romper from Goldfinger. I didn't know you meant the robe.
No,
the robe.
I'm talking about the robe.
Yes, and the robe starts. That I mean, they say that launched the robe for all of James Bond movies for robes, and I thought that was interesting. You brought that up because a lot of clothing is iconic. We know. When someone is at a costume party and they're wearing a tuxedo and carrying a martini, we know who they are. I mean, we know that they want to, they're pretending they're Bond. And it's like all the way up to now, because Daniel Craig can do no wrong. Like, I love that they did an homage to her coming out of the water in a bathing suit by doing Daniel Craig coming out of it. I mean, it's like, and that's another iconic shot that involved a costume piece from Bond that now is lore. I mean, I don't know how many times that's been copied. You two probably know, but it's been copied in so many films in so many ways. It's interesting what we've taken from the canon of Bond movies and what's now in our pop culture to this day. It's very interesting. Yeah. I'm going to look up I bet there's a somewhere that top 10 iconic costumes.
Oh, I'm sure we'll hear from our listeners on that question too. I'll be interested to hear what people say. I mean, you're probably right. It's probably the tuxedo. It's probably is the Goldfinger suit with him leaning up against the Aston Martin. You know, that's hard to beat. But the bathing suit too. I don't know. Those are. We might have to do a poll. Let's do a poll on Facebook and see what happens.
Yeah, because I would vote for the Nehru jacket because I think that actually altered villains for the rest of time. I really do.
Well, I think that does it. That brings us to the conclusion of our 7 minutes. I'm really glad that you decided to come jump in this thing with us.
I like it. I was surprised on the section I got. I was at first really like, we're in a tube for 5 minutes of this bit. But I thought that I was like, Mitch and John, are you playing a joke on me? They're in a tube. You know, like I thought I would get like the lounge singer singing or something, but no, I get the tube. But I'm really glad I did. I enjoyed this.
Well, maybe you'll come back on From Russia with Love and we'll be sure that you have something other than a tube.
No, I know. I'm excited. Now I think I should always be around when we talk about tubes or small containered areas.
Okay.
Stylish fish tanks.
Stylish fish tanks.
Yeah, well, thanks everyone for joining us again this week. Come over to our Facebook page, the 007x7 listeners page. Let us know what you think. I'll put a poll up about the iconic costumes. Let's talk about that over there. We're also on Twitter at 007x7 podcast and Patreon at patreon.com/alienminute. All right, well, we'll see you next week and thanks for joining us.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.